Hi, I'm Corey Rabin. Welcome to Crosstalk Podcast. What do we do here? We inspire recovery from addiction and we discover a better way. Well, whether you're considering a life free from substances or you're already on that path, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding about addiction and recovery. Our mission is simple, to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories of your personal journey to a better life. So buckle up and let's hit the road as we embark on this transformative journey together. This is Crosstalk Podcasts, and we have a great episode for you today. The episode features a singer-songwriter based here in New York, somebody who is a dear friend of mine who I've been bugging to come on Crosstalk for I don't know how long. And today is the day we have Matt Butler with us.
Indeed. Well, I'm glad to finally make my appearance, Corey. You caught me. I've been trying to dodge you for such a long period of time.
You have, but I cornered you and here we are.
And I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me on the show.
You grew up in New York, right?
Yes, sir.
And so tell us a little bit about how that was.
I grew up in Manhattan. I grew up on 64th Street. You know, sometimes I think people say they're from New York, but they're really from like New Rochelle, you know, or Rye. And it's kind of like, technically, yes, you're from New York. But I mean, I'm like a real city kid. And that sounds strange to people who've lived here but didn't grow up here. I think they envision it as some kind of crazy childhood, you know. Growing up in New York, and I went to high school. I went to three high schools, by the way.
Not at the same time.
No. That would have been impressive, though. I graduated from a high school that was like it's what's referred to as progressive education. It's basically like an art school. It's called Elizabeth Irwin or Little Red Schoolhouse down on Varick Street. And, you know, going to a high school in the West Village where you're sort of surrounded by these very kind of like artsy New Yorkers, I feel like you do get exposed to certain things that you wouldn't necessarily get exposed to otherwise.
Is that where your music roots started?
No, music started earlier for me. I really loved music for as long as I can remember. I would say that it took me a long time to sort of admit that and accept that about myself, and then even longer to sort of take the leap to actually trying to play music. But I remember being a little kid and driving in the car with my mother and her playing music and like having songs.
In.
Yeah, having songs stuck in my head all day and like it being my own soundtrack. You know that feeling of like when you're walking down the street with your headphones on and like you're like the movie's playing. Yep. and it's the soundtrack to your life. Like I had that experience when I was like a 4 year old, you know, in the backseat of a car.
So mom and dad, growing up, they were together?
My parents got split. They divorced. Well, they divorced later. They split up when I was like 3-4 years old.
So. You have recollections about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think so. You know, there's certain memories of like them being together that are more, you know, impressionistic than I would say vivid. But inevitably, you know, having parents that split up is a pretty defining event. You know, I think I've gone through different phases in my life of like exaggerating the importance of my parents splitting up and then also downplaying the importance. Because at some point, you know, as you get older and you realize you still have like certain issues and you're like, can this still really be about the fact that my parents split up? Like, is this still about that? Like at age 38, like, am I still dealing with abandonment issues because of my parents' divorce? You know, and so it's a strange thing because it's like, well, did I ever accurately look at it in an encompassing and, you know, a compassionate way? Or
so it's interesting, you know, it's not the first time I've heard the expression or the reference to abandonment issues. How did that kind of play out as you were in your 30s or so? What kind of things happened that made you think, am I still dealing with that?
Yeah, well, like I said, I'm 38 now, so technically still in my 30s, but for just a little bit longer. But I would say that, like, you know, the more you, the more certain, like, repetitious patterns occur in your life, the harder they become to deny over time, at least in my experience, that, like, when you see the same thing play out in some other permutation that occurred when I was 25, at 35, it's like you sort of have to
say, huh.
Yeah, you have to try to really, like, appraise it, especially because you just, you know, I personally don't want to keep reenacting these types of things in my life. But I would say that, you know, abandonment issues play out with sort of being hypervigilant in relationships and wanting to, you know, always waiting for the other shoe to drop and catastrophizing, you know, mm-hmm. having all kinds of catastrophizing thoughts and trying to preemptively respond to things in order to minimize how much they would hurt.
Would you connect those kind of things with any of your alcohol or drug use?
For sure. Yeah.
Was that one of the precipitating factors, you think, or was there a lot of other reasons?
For drinking too much?
Up, so, I mean,
that's a mystery, you know, like I don't know. That's sort of the mystery of addiction. And like, cause I mean, I'm, you know, there are people that don't have issues with drugs or alcohol that have, you know, the same backstory as me, but they don't necessarily like have the experience that I have when I drink. So I can't imagine a scenario where it can be reduced to one thing. You know, does that make sense?
What I hear from a lot of people, I'm not just talking about crosstalk, I'm talking about just people generally, is when I picked up a drink or a drug, immediately I felt like I fit in.
Sure.
And, you know, that's the overriding, you know, kind of arc that I hear. And I identify with that entirely, that before I did that, I felt like, what's the expression, a black tuxedo with a brown pair of shoes. And all of a sudden I was a good dancer. I was funnier. Everything worked out. I had all the girlfriends I wanted, all the friends I wanted. I was the life of the party. It all seemed to be perfect. It was my perception of it. None of it was true.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I can relate to that 100%. I would say that as my drinking progressed, I did not continue to feel that way. You know, when my life was falling apart and I was breaking everybody's hearts around me and hurting my close friends and family, like I certainly did not give me that same sense of belonging. It contributed to a further sense of alienation.
What age did you cross the line where it's stopped being fun?
I was always there. I was there before I even started drinking. Like, I'm a guy who was, you know, kind of on the edge since I can remember. I don't really recall ever there being a time in my life where I felt the absence of that level of self-consciousness.
Interesting. So your parents don't live together. I assume you had a relationship with both mom and dad.
Correct.
And you have a younger brother.
Yeah, I have an older brother who's my full brother. And then my dad is remarried and has two kids. So I have a younger half brother and a younger half sister.
Okay. And how's your relationship with them?
Great. I love them. It's a blessing to have them. It really is cool.
That's great. And I'm sure the little ones look up to you.
You'd have to ask them that question. It's weird. I mean, my little sister is like 15 or 16, and she's like pretty cool. So she's like this 15-year-old, 16-year-old high school girl. And so if she's the cool one, man, as far as like I look up to her, you know, and I want her to think I'm cool. And she makes fun of me because I'm always like trying to like remind her, like, Lauren, at one point, I was cool, I promise you, you know, and my relationship with my younger brother is a little different. He's older, he's like 22, you know, we've kind of bonded over sort of brotherly things. But it's a really nice experience to have because, you know, it's like anything else. Like I can try to avail, you know, I can try to offer them my experience in any ways that I can try to be helpful to them. And
now, I remember, I think there were some times where, because of your drug use, that you had restricted access to your siblings.
To answer your question is, I think, you know, under the influence, I wasn't necessarily always a safe person to be around. And that could mean coming home drunk and leaving a door open. You know, it could mean emotional flare-ups. It could mean, you know, all kinds of different erratic behavior. And also just really setting a bad example, you know, being somebody that you're like, you know, especially for a young kid, like, why is, you know, my brother acting the way he's acting? You know, I think it's really more about that than anything else. It's just like, this is potentially disturbing behavior for a young kid. You know, I got to a point where, like, my behavior under substances became too problematic to be around people, you know?
Did you end up alone?
Sure. Oh, well, I also would use alone deliberately.
Is that your preference?
I mean, yeah, it's hard to say. I think it's just, rather than say preference, I would say it's like, that's what happened. You know what I mean? Like, that's where I led myself to, or where I was led to. I don't think my preferences necessarily played a lot into what the late era looked like for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It's actually, you know, this is what's happening next. It's happening. It's not choices.
Yeah.
But, you know, starting out, I don't think there's a desire to isolate and, you know, do these things on our own. The desire was to fit in and have fun and be social, and you end up in a different kind of place.
I had a pretty close group of different friends in high school that, like, I would get drunk with very regularly and listen to music with, and, like, really classic, like, sit in my bedroom and get wasted and just listen to music and talk bullshit about whatever, you know. But, like, I think that's, like, a kind of a normal, like, high school thing. But there was always, like, a real darkness to me and to what would come out, especially, you know, under the influence. And I tended to gravitate to people that, like, had some of that in them. Like, you know, fortunately, I can say that I do have a couple close friends from those days that are sober now, you know, which is kind of like, you know, it's amazing.
Get sober before you or after you or both?
Well, some people don't, you know, they get sober and then they're not sober and then they get sober again. And, you know, so it's hard to, the timelines are not always concomitant in that way. But, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'll say that sometimes I was sober first, then they were sober first. And then it was like, yeah, leapfrog.
You went to college?
I did.
And tell me a little bit about how that was. You were doing a lot of stuff in high school, I imagine, that continued?
Yeah, yeah. I went to NYU, so I stayed in the city. I'm like super city kid, and definitely drank a ton. And, you know, my freshman year of college was really dark. Which is probably not uncommon, especially for guys. You know, that I really enjoyed my junior and senior year a lot more than my freshman and sophomore year. Tons of isolating when I was a freshman at NYU.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I had gone from being kind of, like, I went to a very small high school, and I grew up in New York, so I knew lots of kids in New York, and I kind of, you know, does it sound arrogant to say I was a big fish in a small pond?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, then at the risk of sounding arrogant, like, I felt like I was a big fish in a small pond. Maybe that was better. I perceived myself that way. Although maybe I didn't perceive myself as in a small pond, but becoming a freshman at NYU, all of a sudden you're a tiny fish in the ocean, and I didn't mean anything to anybody at that point. And right. Girls are dating 32-year-old dudes who, you know, work at ad agencies, and just some 19-year-old kid in a dorm.
Nice restaurants they're getting going to.
And, yeah, it was like...
And you're eating different dorm room.
Dude, the game changed very fast. And, you know, and then in school, it's the same thing. You know, like, I didn't have... Like, nobody knew who I was, and I wasn't really good at making friends in a large environment like that, you know? One of the reasons why I think I became a musician, although this is a tangential reason, the truth about me becoming a musician was I just desperately wanted to be a musician and love music. But tangentially, I felt that it was hard for me to just walk up to someone and say, hey, my name is Matt, particularly walk up to a girl and say, hey, my name is Matt. So I figured if I go on stage and make a spectacle out of myself, they'll come and say hello to me.
Yeah, the guitar is a magnet.
It's something. It's something.
It's true.
It's something. Yeah. I mean, but does that make sense? Like, if I could.
Yeah. Yeah. You have some kind of a thing going for you, you know, as opposed to just being somebody who's sitting in the crowd, you know, clapping like everybody else.
Yeah. And I think I felt sort of so small in my own way that I felt that, like, why would anybody pay attention to me if I didn't really figure out how to distinguish myself and make myself exceptional? Why would anybody care?
Alcohol and drug use, did it accelerate in college, or did it diminish, or was it not an issue?
No, I mean, I just think it was like always. I mean, I kind of, like, by the time I was 15, 16, I was in pretty high gear, pretty young. I mean, it definitely accelerated. There's no question. And I would say that, like, my body's reaction to things changed a
lot. Any consequences as a result of it?
Yeah, sure.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
My whole life consequences, you know, just...
Any arrests?
Yes. That came right before... I got arrested on, like, a Friday night and was supposed to graduate from high school on Monday, where the ceremony was, and I spent the weekend in Central Bookings and got out of Central Bookings like just in time to get to the graduation. And then I had to do a lot of community service at one point, and I was starting NYU, and ironically, or coincidentally, I should say, I had to clean Washington Square Park with like an orange vest on. So I would like be out in Washington Square Park with an orange vest cleaning like rats out of the bathrooms.
And then, like community service?
Yeah. And then go to class, and like people would see me out there, like teachers that were walking around, and like I was just this dude like cleaning the park with a vest on.
It's good you were wearing a vest. They wouldn't be able to tell who you were.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. I would just look like I was a good Samaritan at that point, you know, just a good citizen cleaning the park. I got so many cigarette butts out from the cracks of stones in all the different parks, like all the way downtown, like Father Fagan Park, like little tiny islands, you know, on Sixth Avenue. I was just down there picking the cigarette butts out of the crack. But consequences also, just hurting lots of people, you know, which then in turn was heartbreaking to me.
So, you know, this is a very different interview, and I like it very much. Because we're really not into the weeds of things that everybody goes through. The weeds of things is I did a gram, and then I did two, and then I did four, and then I did six. Fine. Everybody knows that it got out of hand. Could you talk a little bit about what the turning point was? Sometimes we call it a bottom. Why did you make a change, and when did you make a change?
You know, I think I had an idea of the person that I wanted to be, and the person that I felt that I was, but I got to a point where I could no longer really truly deny the reality of who I actually was and who and how I was actually behaving. And, you know, I would say that my sort of conscious relationship with spirituality, in the sense that it's a relationship that I can articulate today, whereas I would say that it might have always been present, but it wasn't something I would be able to have articulated. But I would say that my sort of conscious experience with spirituality began with really understanding that I had a conscience, you know, that there was something inside of me. There was a value system inside of me that I didn't necessarily feel was, and I don't mean this to knock my parents, but that I don't necessarily feel was inculcated in me from my environment. Not to say that they didn't try, but I don't think it took.
Where'd it come from?
Well, that's spirituality for me, is that there's something that was inborn in me. I mean, like there's a presence, a soul, something, you know, but the idea that I felt that I had a sense of right and wrong, and that the longer I continued to live, you know, to use sort of a new agey phrase, to live out of alignment with that, it's heartbreaking. It's painful. And then you can't keep up with it after a certain point. At least I wasn't able to, and that's a blessing. So I would say that that's the bottom that you're talking about.
You don't want to be the person that you had become.
Correct. And it was, and one more thing about that is it's also not the person who I thought I really was. Like, I just, like this isn't who I am, man. Like, this isn't me, you know? And that's spiritual, too, is to be like, there's something else inside of me. Or a spiritual experience is not ecstatic in my experience. It's often frightening and embarrassing. You know, when you have an awakening to something and you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe I said that or I did that. You know, all of a sudden it's a moment of seeing my own behavior in an entirely different light. And I can't tell you why I'm seeing it differently, but I am. And like I said, an epiphany, rather than feeling ecstatic, which is what I was looking for in substance use, it's something that really pulled me down to the ground in a way that was very uncomfortable.
So what'd you do about it? You just walked yourself into a treatment center?
No, I was working for an advertising agency at the time, and I was not performing well there. And I had an inkling that my time there was running short, to say the least. And I somehow miraculously, instead of waiting for that final straw, I had a moment where I just was like, I got to do something here. And I actually came clean to them. And I sent an email to somebody that I worked for telling them that, like, the reason why I have been the way I have been is because I'm really struggling right now. And you know, it was incredible that I was willing to do that at that moment. And it was sort of like one of these things where, like, I can't yank that one back. You know, I can't, like, go into work on Monday and be like, oh, no, by the way, that was just a joke, you know? So I kind of created some degree of accountability for myself, you know, by doing that. And
when you said struggling, did you elaborate?
Yeah. I was struggling with alcohol, with substances, for sure. Right. I was very clear about what was going on. And I was apparently not the first ad man in that place that, you know, struggled with substances. And so apparently it was pretty standard procedure for them. And, you know, this woman whose name is Judy was sort of an angel in my life. And she made arrangements for me because I was not competent, really.
And you were compliant. You followed along. It's great.
Like, I wasn't hiding the reality of it to a lot of people. But, you know, at that, I'd never been in a situation like that. I'd been a musician prior to that. You know, when I graduated college, I was in a band that was signed to Universal Records, and I sort of spent, you know, post college, I was like, this is what I'm doing. And I didn't have that kind of accountability where I had an office to show up to. I did have all kinds of other things I was accountable to, which I was not, and I blew, and I sort of messed up, and I'm not in that band, and that band does not exist at this point, you know. So that was a consequence for me, for sure, was sort of, you know, that opportunity sailed. But, you know, in a lot of ways, this particular set of circumstances and conditions that had been created in my life, as far as like very tenuous living situation, very tenuous financial situation, and this job that required me to show up somewhere, you know, I could have gotten fired and just kind of probably just really just completely fallen off a cliff, and who knows what would have happened at that point, because I had a studio apartment where the lights had been cut off and the toilet was broken, and it was a place that I was sitting in by candlelight.
So you go to treatment when you're 26?
Correct.
Mom and dad involved?
Yes.
Nice. And they were supportive?
Yes. And clearly so were my employers at the time, too.
Absolutely, yeah. And Judy?
I was able to thank her, and she came to see me perform, and I you know, bought her a meal and all kinds of things. And, you know, she was very happy to know that there was a happy ending to that particular story, because it's not always the case, you know.
So you get sober, you're 26, and you're 38 now.
Correct.
So I'm just going to do some quick math.
11 years for me, yeah.
Very good. And can you describe... especially for people who are contemplating making a change and becoming substance free, how do you describe the? I mean, you can't really do 11 years in a few minutes, but what's the difference between the beginning and where you are now? Tell us a little bit about the things that have happened during that time frame, and maybe connect it a little bit to you're taking care of yourself and how things have changed.
Well, there's a lot that's different. I would say, you know, in certain sort of kind of tangible and pragmatic ways, just there are elements of my life that are dramatically more stable and drama-free than there were when I first got sober. Just like health, finances, friends, my relationships with my family, you know, are radically more stable and healthy than they were. You know, I would...
And inside?
I think I know who I am today, for whatever that means to anybody watching this, you know, but I that's not something that I could have said. You know, I feel like I was sort of a shapeshifter throughout the course of my life, and not necessarily always in a dishonest way. I think, you know, there's something natural to trying on a bunch of different roles when you're young and sort of seeing what clothes fit. But I think I know who I am, you know, and I think I have a lot of experience with things going, not going the way I wanted them to go over the past 11 years, and having them turn out in ways that proved to be, you know, more suited to me. I don't want to say better or worse, because I feel like that's sort of a strange qualitative judgment that doesn't, you know, it's sort of a, it's not really better or worse. It's sort of different. Like this, you know, like, I feel like my life fits me, you know, like things occur that are right for me. That's something that I feel I've improved at. But I would also say that for me, that sort of falls under the blanket of like knowing who I am and knowing myself better, like understanding sort of what I have to do to take care of myself, you know, and sort of being self-aware, like, am I saying yes to somebody for something because I'm afraid to say no, and I'm going to just end up blowing this off anyway, you know, but, and causing problems for both of us more than if I just said no, you know, like,
so much easier.
Yeah. So that kind of self-awareness, you know, or am I turning over the decision about something to somebody else because I don't want to be blamed for if the decision is the wrong decision. But then they'll make the decision and then I get to complain about the decision afterwards, you know, because it was them. But like,
another possibility is they make the decision, you get blamed for it.
Oh, well, that's going to happen.
Especially in certain relationships, it happens more than others. So one of the things you and I have connected on is the fact that we both are involved with our own 501c3, our charitable organizations. Could you talk a little bit about what you do in a way to help others?
Sure. And thank you, because I love to share this. It's a big part of my life. I have a 501c3 called Art That Serves, and we work on helping to bring artists and arts programming into correctional facilities. And that's come about as a result of a very long journey for me that started 8 years ago in 2016, where I performed in a jail, in the Albany County Jail. I played a concert for their heroin recovery program, and it was a sort of revelatory experience for me.
What made you want to do that, or how did that come about?
Well, it came about because I was asked to write music for a documentary called Generation Found, which is a documentary about recovery high schools, you know, and teenagers that are struggling with addiction. And I sort of went on tour with that movie when it came out, and I met a lot of people that worked in different types of nonprofit work and advocacy work, and criminal justice and addiction work overlap quite a bit because addiction is such a big part of, you know, why people are incarcerated. And so I got introduced to a bunch of people that, you know, sort of had access to those kinds of things. And then I remember seeing a video of men in a recovery program in a jail on Facebook. Facebook was a big thing then. And they were singing, and I just was like, wow, like music means a lot right there. Like, you know, it struck me as sort of like, that what they were doing, you know, was sort of transcendent. And that's what drew me to music in the first place, was like what music meant in that moment to those guys in that jail is why I like music or love music.
So you felt a draw to that type of situation?
It just felt like it meant something. And I played music my whole life and oftentimes felt like it was self-serving or trying to be self-serving or didn't necessarily mean something, or I was trying to fit in with this or fit in with that or make these people happy or make those people happy or look like this kind of a rock star or look like this dude. And I was always incredibly earnest about what I did to a degree, but it inevitably got masked by all those kinds of layers of things. And I saw these guys singing in a jail and I said, God damn, like that is why I want to play music. And then a part of me was like, just curious. I was like, I wonder what would happen if I played some of these songs that I've written for this movie and about my own story and about addiction. And I went in and I played it for them. Like, would they relate to it?
How'd that feel?
When I did it.
Yeah.
Amazing. I never felt like I'd ever been seen that way by an audience before.
And so that led to Art That Serves?
Yeah. I mean, since then I have played hundreds of concerts and done hundreds of process groups and I have worked in literally over 50 prisons across the United States at this point. I have a list of, you know, prisons that I've been and worked in and 8 years of doing this pretty extensively. And eventually, you know, people started to donate to me personally in order for me to travel to do this work. And at that point, it made more sense to start a 501c3. And then, you know, as I was continuing to do this work, other artists would reach out to me and ask me how they could do something similarly. And before I knew it, I was kind of consulting with a lot of people on how to do stuff. And I had all these relationships. So if somebody, you know, in Virginia reached out to me about how do I do what you're doing? Like, well, I happen to know six sheriffs in Virginia, you know, and, you know, I helped a lot of people bring programs into Rikers Island. And, you know, so I kind of like advise on those types of things at this point. And, you know, Art That Serves is something that is not a full-time job for me. It's not a like a self-sustaining business, but
if people want to, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if people want to contribute to Art That Serves, what do they do?
Just go to our website, which is www.artthatserves.org. And then it's, you know, you can just donate right there on the secure payment portal that we have.
And it's 100% tax deductible.
100%. Exactly. So end of year filings are coming up, everybody.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Get those breaks now while you can.
Now you do other things, because I've been to multiple Matt Butler shows in the New York City metropolitan area.
Correct.
Downtown, uptown, inside, outside. And I love your shows. You also do a one-man show.
Yes.
I want you to brag a little bit, if you don't mind, about what you're doing as an entertainer.
Sure. Well, you know, the reality was that the prison work really sort of took central focus in my performing life. And I wrote a lot. I started writing a lot of songs about my experience working in prisons, a lot of songs based on the stories of the incarcerated people I was meeting. And I'd kind of, you know, when I would play for the public, I would sort of tell these stories behind the songs I was going to perform and tell them about people that I'd met. And, you know, a lot of these things were people, you know, they kind of know that the incarcerated are there. They have an abstract idea that there are people out there that are in prisons, but they don't necessarily have a concrete experience or sort of understand the path to getting there and sort of how easily it really could be anybody.
And to some extent, I think there are probably a majority of people know about it, but really don't want to know too much about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
The more, you know, it's too much information.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable thing, no right. question.
But you go right, you dive right into it, and you've created art from that.
Yeah, well, so my one-man show is, at some point I just decided to turn what I was doing into a codified thing. And so I do a show, it's called Reckless Son, and it's a combination of monologues and songs, and the monologues sort of introduce the songs. It's 9 monologues and 9 songs, and it runs about an hour long.
And you have visuals.
Yes. It can be a wide range of productions. I could do it in this room just with that guitar, or I could do it on a stage with, you know, proscenium and projectors and all that kind of stuff. I do it with a little wireless microphone and so forth.
Oh,
and
Mr. Big Shot, a wireless,
yeah.
huh?
Yeah, like a little TED Talk microphone. And but it's cool because now the show has been growing, and I'm doing it in a lot of performing arts centers around the country. And what I'll do typically is I'll go to a city and I'll do the show in a performing arts center, and I'll do it as like a residency where while I'm there, I'll also do the show in a prison in their community, or I'll do it in a treatment center in their community. And the show, you know, becomes more of this sort of community event where people from the prison, the staff, you know, families of the incarcerated, we typically invite and provide either free tickets or discounted tickets for people from reentry programs or from sober livings or, you know, groups that are connected to that kind of content, and we'll bring all these people together.
You know what I love about the content that I've seen with you performing for the incarcerated is that the folks that are there start sharing in ways that they probably hadn't done before you got there. There's a honesty, there's a rawness, there's an emotional availability that I don't think is par for the course in that kind of an environment. I think it's quite the opposite. But when you bring your music in and the message that you bring in of your own honesty and your own story and their stories, it triggers things that happen that I think make real changes in their lives.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, and I agree with that in the sense that I think it does like change the energy in a space, you know, that allows people to experience a degree of intimacy that they might not otherwise experience.
The women's prisons I'm thinking of, you know, that I mean, some of the women are they're incredible, some of the things that they realize when they're there, and the stories of when they get out and making real change.
Yeah.
So we talked about Art That Serves. If somebody wants to know more about your music, where do they go to find that out?
My website is www.mattbutlersongs, S-O-N-G-S, and my name is M-A-T-T-B-U-T-L-E-R. Or you could look up Matt Butler on Spotify or iTunes.
So before, that's one way to find out about Matt's music. Another way is to hear him sing, which I've asked him to bring his guitar, which is sitting over there on the desk, and he's going to do that. There is a particular song that I love of yours that I'm going to ask you to sing. But before I do that, there's one question I want to ask you.
Sure.
If you were in a position to give any advice to the young Matt, maybe somebody whose age is, I don't know, 8, 10, 12, whatever, is there something that you've learned over this 38-year arc of your life that you'd like to share with young Matt that you think might be useful?
So many things, but the first thing that came to my head was just to say, hold on, man, it's going to get better. You know, it's not always going to be like this. I could say there are a lot of things I regret. There are a lot of opportunities that I blew. There are a lot of relationships that I blew. And it's like, would I give myself advice to be like, don't say this to, so-and-so when you do that? You know, like, it's not like I would give myself advice to sort of like fix or prevent, you know, I'd go back in time and do a Back to the Future and change the course of history and be, you know, that band that I was in won't break up and all. Like, I wouldn't do anything like that. And that's almost part of the advice that I would give too, is like, it's going to work out the way it's supposed to work out.
So usually the way we close Crosstalk is with me thanking everybody for watching and listening, telling them that I'll see you next time. But I'm not going to say that. We're going to go out with the song that I love that I asked you to sing, and I'm going to let you introduce it. You got to get your guitar, right?
I think I asked too many questions. I know I'll never understand. How to help all those around me. I am just one man. There's so many who feel helpless, that there's just too much to be done. But I know it makes all the revolution has begun. If I can help just one, and he can help just one, and she can help just one, if we can help just one.